Welcome to the 12th message of our series, Fight for Faith, the study of the life of David. Keep watching as we see in David's life the deceptive nature and destructive potential of anger, as well as the healing and transforming power of a wise and soft answer.
You know, as we dive into this, you know, I want to realize that, you know, we're thinking about an issue of anger. You know, as I think about this, all of us have done things in the past when we were driven by anger that we later regretted. We lose our temper, we end up saying or doing something that we wish that we wouldn't, we wish we could take back. And when we cool down, we go back and we usually then will apologize to the person that we've wronged, saying something like, I'm really sorry, please know that wasn't like me. I mean, how many of us have said something like that? You know, we explain we've lost our temper, and we hope that to some degree people understand that our anger is an acceptable excuse, because everyone gets angry. It's only human to get angry. And we hope that the other party accepts that anger is an acceptable excuse and sees that it wasn't us. It was the anger that caused us to act that way. Now think about that when we say a response or an excuse like, you know, well, what I said, what I did, it really wasn't me. It was just, I just got angry. What we're saying is that there's a sense that our anger has caused us to lose control of our behavior. It has caused us to act in a way that is inconsistent with who we really are on the inside. Now here, let me ask you a question. From a psychological perspective, what do you call it when someone is out of control of their behavior and is enacting in a way that they can't control?
Insanity.
That's exactly right. You know, we call that insanity. You're insane when you're out of control of your behavior. Now, what that suggests is when we say, well, I'm angry and that wasn't me, what we're in a sense saying is that I lost control, and we're in a sense saying that when we're angry, we can be driven to a point of temporary insanity. That there's a sense that we allow our behavior to control us, and we, in a sense, are becoming temporary insane. Now, I want you to realize that when we say that anger is only human, yes, that's true, that anger is an emotion, actually a God-given emotion that we all have, that we all at times will become angry. Everyone has to learn to deal with anger, but it's not only human in the sense that everyone has to be controlled by it. Anger is a choice and a habit. It's a learned reaction to frustration, which we sometimes then use as an excuse to when we act in a way that we later regret. Now, the problem for too many of us at times is that we have, when we become angry, we make the choice to run into the anger. Instead of learning to control it, we run into the anger. And when we run into the anger, we develop the habit then of allowing that anger to control us, thinking that it's a justified excuse. Now, let me give you a real-life example of this. I mean, it's extreme, but it's real life. Do you know that statistics show that an average of 13 people are killed each year by vending machines? Over twice as many people get killed each year by vending machines than do by sharks. And you look at that and you say, why does it happen? Because people go and they put money in a vending machine and they don't get what they expect, and they get so frustrated that they begin to tip the machine to the point that it tips over on them and crushes them to death. And each one of those people have become a victim of their own temporary insanity, because it's insane for what they're doing. Now, before we congratulate ourselves for not being that dumb, I would never do that. What we have to realize is that each one of us have shaken our relationships with other people when we become angry. Each one of us have crushed our spouse or our children by our words driven by anger, or we've killed our reputation by actions that we've done when we were driven by anger. As I said in the beginning, all of us can look back in our times and we see things that we've done driven by anger that we later regret. We wish we could take back, that we would like to say, that's not me. We all struggle with anger. We all struggle with the temptations of temporary insanity. As we look at this passage this morning in the life of David, what we see is we see a great man, a man who is elsewhere in the Bible described as a man after God's own heart. We see in the context of this man who just the previous chapter, chapter 24, probably only a short period of time ago in time, had shown tremendous patience and grace towards King Saul, a man who was trying to kill him unjustly. And David showed patience and grace by refusing to take justice in his own hands and letting him go. And that same man is now controlled by temporary insanity of anger. And if it were not for the intervention of a woman that he had never met before, he would have, by that anger, been guilty of the murder of multiple people. Now, I want to acknowledge it's been a couple weeks since we've looked at David. So what I want to do is that I want to step back and take a minute to remember a little bit of the context of the story. Because if we see the context, it will help us understand a little bit of what's happening here. If you remember, as a very young man, David, he was probably just in his mid-teens, was thrust from obscurity into the national stage of being a national hero. He went from the youngest son of a poor family, you know, taking care of the sheep of his dad, to next thing you know, he's being called out, and he's taking on the giant Goliath, whom he defeats, literally in the process, you know, winning a great battle for the whole country, and becomes an incredible hero. And from that point on, he had a rise that was meteoric. I mean, he was invited then into the king's house, to live in the king's household. He becomes best friends with Jonathan, the crown prince. He ends up marrying one of Saul's daughters, becomes a part of Saul's family. He is made at a very young age a general in the army and is one of the best known warriors in the whole nation. And this rise in prominence and popularity were so great that King Saul began to notice it and began not only to become jealous of the fact that he was now more popular than Saul was with many people, but he also began to become worried. He began to feel threatened. Not because anything that David had ever done. David was always nothing more than a faithful servant. But he was threatened because he was insecure in himself. And out of his own insecurity and jealousy, driven by these things, David, you know, Saul became so threatened by David that he ordered him killed. And David found out about that, and he runs away. And then not only does he run away, but Saul then literally gathers soldiers to go hunt him. And so there is a period of years where David has been on the run, being hunted by King Saul. And over time, you know, we saw that part of the story is that there's all these other people that likewise had problems that went to David for protection. And next thing you know, he's got 600 men who are part of his, you know, his entourage in a sense. And he then trains these men. They become mighty warriors. And in the middle of this, David's learning to be able to rely on God and faith throughout, you know, throughout this time. And we saw then in chapter 24, last time we were studying, that he showed an incredible act of faith and faith in God through the patience and grace that he showed towards Saul. In chapter 24, we saw that King Saul had come out with 3,000 men hunting David. And in the middle of this, as they're going out to hunt David, you know, David's hiding in this cave, and it just so happens that Saul goes into this cave to go to the bathroom by himself, and he's by himself in the most vulnerable places. And all David's men said, okay, God gave you Saul. You know, this is your chance to take your revenge. This is your chance to kill him. This is your chance to become the king that God promised that you would become. And David was unwilling to take matters into his own hands. He had the faith that said, no, if God's going to do that, God will accomplish that. God hasn't made me judge and jury here. You know, I'm going to show the faith and patience to be able to wait for God to do his thing. And in the process, he shows grace towards Saul. Where Saul was, you know, trying to kill him, he said, I'm refusing to go down to that level and to take matters into my own hands like Saul would. And so you see this incredible statement of faith and patience and grace. But in the middle of that, what's amazing is that he shows this patience and faith, but it doesn't carry over to the next story. And I think what happens here is something that is true for our own life, that often we can focus on one challenge, one relationship, one place where anger is an issue or frustration, and we can feel like we're doing so well here, but one victory in one part of our life doesn't always spill over to victories in other areas of our life. You know, we might even, you know, read of David here and say, man, I couldn't have the faith that that David had to let Saul go like that. And David might have been looking at his own life and saying, man, I'm pretty good. You know, they all wanted to kill Saul. And I said, I have faith in God. But before he's done polishing his halo, you know, God reveals that he hadn't won total victory. And there's an important warning here. That anger is devious and it hides within our soul. And just because we have success in one area doesn't mean that we've gained success over the whole. There's a self-deceptive nature in anger. And often that is demonstrated in transference. Now here's what happens, is we all have this incredibly complicated tendency that's true for all of us. What happens, you know, we can see it when somebody else is guilty of it, we see it in them, we can never see it in ourselves. Here's what happens. We're mistreated by someone who has authority or control over us, or we're mistreated by someone that we feel like we can't get back. And so what we do is we don't take our frustration out toward them because we can't, but we don't deal with it fully. And what happens is we respond by taking out that frustration by mistreating someone else. Or maybe it's the environment. You know, we're in an environment at work, and boy, we're so frustrated. We feel that we've been wronged in so many ways, and we can't set things right there, but we respond by finding another environment where we feel like we have some control or some freedom, and then we mistreat people in that environment. And so, you know, here we are. We're angry, but because we feel it's not safe to show our anger towards that person who's wronging us, or in the context where the main problem is occurring, what we do is we take it somewhere else. We telegraph it not at the person whom we're really frustrated at, but at someone else whom it's safer to show our anger towards. We transfer the anger. We transfer the frustration from the person who is wronging us or the circumstance that's frustrating us to another person or to another circumstance where we feel it's safer to express that anger and frustration. And the problem is that we feel powerless in the one setting. We're angry, we're frustrated, we feel powerless, but then we often then compensate by trying to take another situation where we feel like we have some power and expressing our frustration and anger in that environment. And that's what I think is happening here. You know, you have David who recognizes, you know, Saul's king, and he's rightly looking at that and saying, well, he has the right person of authority, and it's wrong for me to be able to kill the king. And he's struggling with that, and he understands it. But in the middle of that, you've got to realize that Saul's still chasing him. And even though he's doing what's right, it's got to be frustrating for him to have Saul continuing to chase him, for him continuing to be on the most wanted list, even though he's done nothing wrong, and he doesn't deal with that frustration, and it builds. And what we're going to see is that David then responds to a situation that, yes, he was wronged, but he overreacts. And I think a big part of the reason he overreacts is because of the transference of his anger and frustration. Now, we've got to ask ourselves, when are we guilty of that? Man, it's hard to see that in ourselves. And sometimes we have to be willing to listen to someone else who sees it in us. And we have a tendency, no, it's not me. But we've got to be able to see that that's natural unless we're careful. Now, let's see what happens here. When we look at David, what we see is that he responds to a situation where he's wronged. And there is a sense of righteous anger. It's not that anger is wrong. It's not that it's wrong to feel angry. That when we look at this again, anger is something that we are created in. God gets angry at sin. And here you have David. He receives evil for doing good. And there's a righteous anger. The problem isn't that there was anger. It's what he did with the anger. His overreaction. His temporary insanity, and it's just wanting to excuse that. So again, let's go back to chapter 25. And here's some things there's going to be a lot in here that we've got to explain to some of the culture to help you understand this. In that day, Israel was under King Saul, and he was responsible for leading the army and for protecting the people, for making the land a safe land. Now, the problem is that Saul has the army out chasing David, not protecting the land. And in the process, he's making it a less safe place. Now, you've got to understand, in the time that David lived, it was a very lawless time. And it wasn't just about cities where there was, you know, where there was authority. Many of the people lived out in the country, in the rural areas, especially those who were wealthy. And we think in our time that those who are wealthy are going to live in the cities, are going to have the big, you know, big houses. In that time, what you've got to realize is that wealth was in livestock. So if you had somebody that was incredibly wealthy, let's say somebody that, you know, even partially wealthy, you have 100 sheep, you know, where do you put that in your backyard if you're in a walled city? If you have 1,000 sheep, you've got to be out in the, you've got to be out in fields, in these large fields. So that's where the wealthier people live. But the problem was, if you're out in the middle of this, you know, these large fields, it made you a ripe target for bandits and for thieves. And so what would happen is that people would get together and they would attack these outposts. They would attack and they would steal the sheep. They would, you know, it was a very dangerous environment. And so what was common was that groups of men would allow themselves to be hired out by these wealthy people to kind of provide security, to provide protection for the families and the sheep. Now that's the context. When you read everything we're going to read here in chapter 25, that's the context. All right, if you have your Bibles, let's go to verse 2 of chapter 25. There was a man in Moen whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. Now, literally, it says he was heavy. It was, you know, the idea he's loaded. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. Again, we don't read much, but their wealth was in livestock. That's very, very wealthy. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. The name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife was Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and behaved badly. He was a Calebite. Now, it's interesting, even here, the name Nabal means fool. Literally, that's what the name means, which makes you wonder about his parents. You know, what do you want to name our child? Let's name him Fool. That's a great name. And, you know, you wonder. Now, it's interesting, though he's described as a fool, that doesn't mean that he was stupid. No, he had great business sense. He was smart to the degree that he had built up great wealth. But he was a fool in that, the Bible says that the fool is one who says there's no God or that lives as there's no God. So here's a man who is very smart, has great business sense, but he doesn't appeal to God's truth as to what's right and wrong. And you see his decisions made here are not based on any sense of ethics, but sense based on what works. And we'll see how this played out in his life. Now, we hear of Nabal. And we read that, you know, that he was a fool, that he was shrewd. And he's married to a wife, Abigail, who's not at all like him. She's described as discerning. Literally, she had great understanding. She's wise. And she's very beautiful. So we read of these people. Now look at verse 4. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing sheep. So David sent 10 young men. And David said to the young men, go up to Carmel and go up to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus you shall greet him. Peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shears, and now that your sheep have been with us, and we did no harm to them, and they missed nothing all the time that they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give us whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David. Now, here's where we can struggle with what's happening, because we read this and we have, you know, we don't live in this context, and we're like, what in the world's going on? Well, let me explain a little bit of it here. What's happening here is that David, again, has been helping Nabal. He's been protecting his sheep. He's been, in a sense, the private security. But it's not something that was ever officially contracted. They came over and they provided this protection, you know, kind of informally. And what would happen is that it was common where people would do this. And if you provide that security, then at times of shearing, when basically you sell the profits, you have all these profits that you would have the person that had been provided for would give basically a tip. I mean, the closest we could come to this is you think about it, and you go to a restaurant, if you have great service and a really great meal, there's no legal obligation to give a tip, but there's an expected moral obligation, right? And so what happens is that here, he's been doing this for months. And he comes to him, and he basically is asking for this, for this tip. Not legally, legally necessary, but morally and ethically correct. Now, just to give you an idea of what he's been doing, look at verse 15. Later on, some people go to explain what he's been doing. They said, the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm, and we did not miss anything when they were with us in this field, as long as we went with them. They were a wall to us by day and night, and all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. So here's what he's saying. They're providing security. They're keeping away raiding parties. Anytime a sheep would wander away, they would send it back in. They totally protected us. There wasn't a legal contract, but there was a moral contract that was implied. And so now that they're shearing the sheep, David sends people, and look what he says, verse 7. He says, I hear that you have shears. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did no harm. They missed nothing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please get whatever you have at your servants, at hand, your servants, your son David. Now he's ordinary custom. and he's coming. He doesn't go himself, he sends his men. He doesn't make demands, he gives a request. He doesn't presume, you know, that everything that you're seeing here is a spirit of graciousness. Send whatever you will. Now look at the response, verse 9. When David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and then they waited. And when it says they waited, it means that likely Nabal asked about David, confirmed the reports, made sure that he knew everything that had happened. And it also means that his response is thought out. Look at verse 10. And Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters." Now what you're seeing is you're seeing in this response, he knows exactly who David is. This isn't a question, this is an insult. He's not only saying, "I'm not going to give you anything," he's basically, "Let me start by insulting David and who he is." And he's a nobody. He's somebody that's running from Saul. You know, why should I be at all concerned with the guy that, you know, that has trouble with the king? And then he goes on in verse 11, "Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my sharers, and I give it to men whom I do not know where?" And he's saying, basically, you know, where's the signed contract? You know, this is what I've done. Show me the signed contract. I never promised anything from David. Now, there was an implied promise. He knew all the time that David was there. There was an implied promise of saying, "Oh, thank you for, you know, doing this." And it was implied very clearly, but he's coming and saying, "Well, you know, there's, you know, I'm going to be the shrewd guy. There's no legal contract. I can get away with it." And what we see is that, man, we have people that live by that standard in our day. That shrewdness in business, and that's part of our culture. But what we need to realize that, no, the question isn't always what's legal, it's what's right, what's moral, what's ethical. And there are times as followers of Christ that we shouldn't be driven by the letter of the law and what can I get away with. It's before God what is right. And this man isn't concerned about that. He is very wise in business dealings, but a fool when it comes to issues of God. And what you see is that he's also not thinking about the implications of what he's doing. That he's got this armed party that's been protecting him, who he not only now gives nothing, but he sends back with insults. And so what is David's response? What is our natural response? I mean, when somebody wrongs us in some way, you know, we become angry. We feel we deserve better. We feel like we have the right to become angry. And what anger is, it's saying, "You've wronged me, I deserve better, and I withhold the right to seek justice." And then when I take revenge, that's my seeking justice. That's trying to put things right. And whereas, again, it's natural to get angry. Anger should never be an excuse for temporary insanity. As Ephesians 4 says, it says, you know, be angry and do not sin. We're going to be angry, but it's never an excuse for wrong, sinful behavior. Now, again, David is the same man who had reason to be angry with Saul. Saul's been hunting him for years. And yet when he's given an opportunity to seek justice, he said, "No, I'm going to be gracious and patient." But now when this man throws a series of insults at him, a much smaller offense, what you see is he sees red. He sees red and he's ready to go to battle. Look at what happens, verse 12. David's young men turned away and came back and told him all of this. So he tells him the whole report. Not only did we not get anything, but he just gave us insults. And David said to his men, "Every man strap on his sword," and every man of them strapped on his sword. And David strapped on his sword, and about 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage. Now, I think it's pretty clear when you put on your sword, you're not going to have a chat. You know, and it's not only that, but he's got 400 men going after Nabal. I mean, this guy's like total overkill. And again, this amazing thing is this is the same man that just a few months ago demonstrated incredible patience towards Saul. And now he's seeing red and he's driven by temporary insanity and willing to not only go kill Nabal, but all the men that are there. And I'm sure that David would respond, you know, man, you know, in fact, we see later on, he comes back and justifies. He's walking there and he's justifying, okay, this is why this is right. And this is why, you know, man, he deserves this. But here's what I want you to ask. Here we have David, who is angry because someone has insulted him and threatened him. And his response is to get an army together to go down and hunt him down and kill him. Who is that like? Saul. the thing that he's really angry at with Saul is exactly the man that he's becoming now. He's becoming like his enemy. He's be letting anger allow him to become the person that he hates. And we do the same thing. We do the same thing if we're not careful. And what we need to realize is that God calls us to be people that, yes, we become angry, but it should never be an excuse to sin, that we shouldn't allow ourselves to be overcome by evil, but we overcome evil with good, with righteousness, with grace and patience. Now, in the middle of this, you have him he's temporarily insane. He's going to kill. And then God intervenes through Abigail. And we see an incredible, the transforming power of a soft answer and a wise response. You know, I love Proverbs chapter 15. 15:1 says this, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Look what happens, verse 14. One of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master, and he railed against them. And yet these men were good to us, and we suffered no harm, and we did not miss anything when we were in the fields, as long as we went with them. And they were a wall to us by night and day, all the while they were keeping the sheep. Now therefore, know this, and consider what you shall do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his house, for he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him. Now they know there's a problem. They know this was really dangerous. It's interesting, you know, they maybe tried to speak to him, now they go to her, because they know that she's wise and discerning. And it's amazing her response. You see, she doesn't go to Nabal and yell at him, and how dare you do this, and what are you doing? Nor does she say, okay, well, let me gather the defenses and try to get everyone together. But she knew something about what it says in Proverbs, a soft answer turns away wrath. And I want you to see, we're going to look at this, but I want you to see several traits that made her response so persuasive, that literally changed everything that David was about to do. Look at verse 18. Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves and 2 skins of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 shelahs of parched grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and laid them out on donkeys. And she said to her young man, go before me. Behold, I come after you. And she did not tell her husband Nabal. And she rode on the donkey and came down under the cover of mountains. And behold, David and his men came down towards her and she met them. Now here she's going, she prepares this as a gift to kind of soften him up. And then as she's riding there, we're told that they're riding there and you see what David is thinking. David is justifying his behavior. He's saying, here's what I'm doing, here's what's right. Look at verse 20 or 21. Now David said, surely in vain I have guarded all this fellow has done in the wilderness so that nothing was missed, all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. I did good, he gave me evil. That justifies anger. God do so to the enemies of David, and more also if by morning I do not leave as much as one male to all who belong to him. I'm going to kill the whole household because they deserve it. And you see that justification. And then into this, God brings Abigail. And look at what she says, verse 23. When Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell down before David on her face and bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, on me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now, we're going to see this response, and this is amazing. What she does now is she uses her unique, God-given, feminine power to influence. Her response we're going to see here is amazing. Because what she does is she begins to deal with David, treating him as the man she hopes that he will be. Not the man that he is, not the man that's anger and ready to go kill a bunch of people, but the man whom she hopes that he will become. Now, women, this is vital because when you look at what the Bible teaches about masculinity and femininity, and especially in the context of marriage, it says some things that are amazing, and you see them played out here. You know, You know, the thing is, there's a principle here that even if we know this, when you do this, it still works on us. That, you know, that if you say, if you tell us something about ourselves, we live up to it. I'm going to give you an example of that. You know, if sometimes we're, you know, we're upstairs in bed at night and Sandy will say something like, you know, here's something downstairs. You know, what is that? And, you know, and now she might sometimes say, well, go check it out. You know, here's something. It might be something dangerous. Go check it out. And I want to tell you, my natural response, I think most of us, our natural response when you say something like that is, why? You know, I'm comfortable in bed, I'm sleeping, I'm not worried about it. And I think about it, and you say, your response is, you think, there, I hear something dangerous, why don't you go and walk into it? It's like, man, I thought you loved me. You know, just like, and that's our natural response. But my wife has learned this trick. You know what she says now? She'll say something along the lines of, you know, I hear something downstairs, and I'm so thankful I'm married to a man who's a strong protector like you. And you make me feel so safe as a protector. Now, she doesn't even have to ask me to go down there. And I sit there and I said, I'm her protector. Man, I want to be her protector. I get up and I'm going to go find a weapon. I've got a shoe and it's a flip-flop. Well, that's okay. It's not a great weapon, but I'm going to go down there and I'm going to take on whatever is there because I want to be the man and protector she thinks I am. And it's amazing. It works. See, she understood this God-given feminine power. And what she does in using this is she spoke to David's potential, looking beyond where he is and calling out who he could be. Where is he right now? I mean, he's out there temporary insane, willing to go kill a bunch of people. And she speaks to him not that way, but she talks to who he could be. Look at this. Look at verse 26. Now, my Lord, as the Lord lives, as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving you with his own hand. She's saying, God's already stopped you. You know, and then verse 20, she continues on. Blood restrained you from this. 27. Now let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who follow the Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant, for the Lord will certainly make my Lord's house secure, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil shall not be found as long as you live. Basically, you know, I'm going to give you this, and I trust you. Your whole life is about fighting for God. Your life is for doing what's good. God will bless you because that's who you are. That's not who he is right now. He's a guy that's going out to kill a bunch of people that don't deserve it. But she says, I see who you could be. And she calls this out. You know, she says, verse 29, if men rise up and pursue you and seek your life, the life of the Lord shall be bound up on the living and the care of the Lord your God. And the lives of your enemies shall be slings shot out from the howl of the sling, or stones shot out from the howl of the sling. She refers to a sling, reminding him back. Do you remember back when you did fight the battle of the Lord? When you had great faith, when you trusted God to win these battles. And she calls him out, literally challenging him now to think beyond the moment and asking him, David, what kind of story do you want your life to tell? And she says, you know, one day, you know, verse 30, when you look at this, you know, the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs or conscience for having shed blood without cause. And here's what she's saying. You know, one day God's going to make you king. And David, when you're king, what stories do you want to tell? Do you want to be like Saul who goes out and kills a bunch of people because it got him mad? Or do you want to be a man of character who does what's right and who doesn't abuse his power, that doesn't use anger as an excuse for sin? And what she does is amazing. And what you see is him totally change his behavior and said, okay, I'm not going to kill y'all. I'm going to let it go. And what a powerful response. It's a powerful response. It says an awful lot, not only about anger, but about the power of a soft answer, even about the power of feminine influence. I wish we could spend more time developing that. But it also says something else, because a lot of times we could sit there and say, but what if I don't feel like I have it in me? You see, it also echoes and shadows an incredible truth, and that is that the gospel has power to speak righteousness into our life. And I might be there and say, but I've always gotten angry, and this is who I am, but I've always done this, and I've done these things. And people could try to speak truth to us, and we're, you know, like, but this is who I am. That's what we believe. And what is the power and the message of the gospel? That is who we are. The gospel is, I recognize that I am a sinner before God, that I deserve his wrath, but I ask Jesus to forgive my sins, and he gives me righteousness that I don't have. And he gives me that righteousness, and he speaks truth into my life so that it changes me and transforms me from the inside out. Look at Romans 3. It's not up on the screen, but the righteousness of God has been made manifest apart from the law. It's a righteousness that's not what we accomplish. It's not based on what we do. It's a righteousness that is from God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. For there's no distinction. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. All of us have these struggles, but we are justified by his grace. grace is a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. Praise be to God. Because we can sit there and we can say, but I've made those mistakes and I've been insane and I'm struggling with it now. I don't know how to have victory. And man, I'm thankful for the people that have the soft answer. But how do I gain victory? Yes, there are times that we find the people and we listen and we reflect and we try to obey God, but ultimately we come and we say, God, I need you to speak truth into my life. I need you to give me righteousness that I don't have. God, I struggle with these things and I don't know how to have victory. It's not in me. You see, religion is all about what's in you and you try harder. Faith in Christ is, God, I acknowledge it's not in me. And what I need isn't for more self-control. What I need is a heart transformation. And that comes by faith in Jesus Christ. And no matter where we're at, how many times we've messed up, how deep our struggle is, how deeply enslaved we are to anger, to lust, to all these different things that would destroy us, if we come and we say, God, I admit my need, I ask you to speak truth into my life, speak righteous in my life that only the gospel can, he will. And are we willing to come to him and acknowledge our need and surrender to his grace, allowing him to change us from the inside out?
Thanks for watching. If you have any questions about what we talked about, Jesus Christ or church, feel free to reach out to us on Facebook, Instagram, or by email. The links are in the description.